Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I do feel the need and the calling to spend a couple of minutes before I get onto the topic of the Lord of the Rings to say something of the power of the C.S. Lewis Foundation in my own life. I may be getting some of these facts wrong, because when you get to my age, it all becomes a bit of a blur. But I believe my first engagement with the C.S. Lewis Foundation was in 2003 at the University of San Diego in California. I met a young high school senior, well, I've never met an old high school senior yet, but I met a high school senior in San Diego, and he was very intense, this young man. Since then, he stayed in touch, and he's went to college, got his master's, got his theology, got married, and now he's teaching theology at the University in Louisiana. So yeah, as Andrew was saying about these lifelong friends we make, 2004 was my first time here, which is the first time I did meet Andrew. I've been here, this is my third time, been to Oxbridge, I think, three times. And my very special memory and my great debt of gratitude to the C.S. Lewis Foundation was in 2005 at Oxbridge. I was due to give, I gave one talk, but my second talk I had to cancel because my father was rushed into hospital. And I take it as a great act of God's love and providence that I happened to be, because I was living over here and he's in England, happened to be only 65 miles from him because he died within a few days. He had a very holy death, thanks be to God, and I'm sure that one of the reasons for that was I had the whole Oxbridge C.S. Lewis conference praying for him. And I certainly felt uplifted, and I could tell that he did. So that's a debt some unrepayable. And I didn't want to say goodbye to this conference without, if you like, reminiscing about some of the things that this foundation has done for me. So thank you so much. The Lord of the Rings is an astonishing publishing phenomenon. My first book on Tolkien Man and Myth, was written in response to the negative response to the fact that The Lord of the Rings, in a whole number of opinion polls of various types, national opinion polls in the UK, Lord of the Rings was winning, hands down, 50% more votes than anybody else, the greatest work of the century, 20th century, greatest work of all time. And the response of supercilious critics was one of scorn, and one critic who responded, "Well, this just shows the folly of teaching people to read." But beyond the opinion polls, actually, since then, the last 5 or 10 years, there's been some. What's the best selling work of literature of all time, and at number one is almost definitely Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes. And I sometimes say here, just to be controversial, because being controversial is fun, that the only reason that Don Quixote is the best-selling book of all time is the Spanish only ever wrote one book. I'm sorry, no, I know that's a little rubbish. It actually just reflects my own ignorance of Spanish literature, but it's funny. But it certainly is true that every high school student in the Spanish-speaking world reads Don Quixote, because it is the classic that everyone has to read. So this is the other factor. Yes, it's number one, but how many of those copies that were sold because people were forced to buy it? Right, as a set text at high school or college. Similarly, the second best-selling book of all time appears to be A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. But again, and it's a wonderful book, of course, but how many people first read Tale of Two Cities because it was a set text at high school or college? The third best-selling book of all time is The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is hardly ever taught at college or high school level, which means people have gone out and bought it because they wanted to, not because they had to. And of course, it's only been published 60 or 70 years, unlike the others that have been published, in the case of Don Quixote, 500 years, 400 years. I teach literature because I can't do math. So what is this about this phenomenal work of literature? That's the most, you know, the most popular book, one of the best-selling books of all time. Well, most people wouldn't know it, but Tolkien said there's a hierarchy of, a scale of significance about what the relationship between him as the author and the Lord of the Rings as the work. And at the very top of that, which is the most important in this scale of significance, says the fact I am a Christian, which can be deduced from my stories, and in fact a Roman Catholic. That's the quote. And elsewhere he says, the Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. Unconsciously at first, consciously in the revision. So the millions and millions of people in the Lord of the Rings, many of whom are not Christians, many of whom are atheists or believers in other religions, agnostics, are being moved closer to Christ without knowing it. And we know the one thing that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis said was in the secular age in which we find ourselves, you have to get past those watchful dragons. Yes. And certainly to have a fundamentally Christian work, which is one of the most popular and best-selling books of all time, he's obviously succeeded in getting past those watchful dragons. But how? Well, obviously there's subtlety, because there's no mention, of course, of Christ in the Lord of the Rings. So it's subsumed within the story, and in what way is it? So one thing that Tolkien says in his essay on fairy stories, echoing what Hamlet says, is that art holds up a mirror to man. It shows us ourselves. So what I want to do is to look at what the Lord of the Rings shows us about ourselves. And let's begin with the real basics. What sort of cosmos is Middle Earth set in? Well, we're told in the very opening line of the Silmarillion, in the beginning was the One, capital O. In the beginning was the One, Ilúvatar, the father of all. So in the very first sentence, we know, and of course this echoes Genesis and deliberately, that the Middle Earth is our cosmos, not another cosmos, and it's a monotheistic cosmos. It's not an atheistic cosmos, it's not a cosmos with no God, it's not a polytheistic cosmos, a cosmos with many gods, it's a monotheistic cosmos created by Ilúvatar, the father of all, the All-Father. So that's the world in which we find ourselves, but what sort of world is it? It's a fallen world, because God brings the cosmos into being through the great music. So I mentioned this in my talk Friday, that God is the creator, as the artist, and he's the great composer of the symphony of creation. But then there's some profound theology. Because what God does not do is say, I'm presenting to you this beautiful, great music, this symphony of creation. Listen. He says, I'm presenting to you this great music, this symphony of creation. Play. So it's as if God gives us the score, the rules by which we should be playing. And then the mightiest of all the angels, who's called Melkor, which means mighty one, decides he doesn't want to keep to the score. He wants to weave his own dark themes, and discord and disharmony enters the great music. And there's a war in heaven. And Melkor is thrown from heaven. And the language that Tolkien used in the Silmarillion is very similar to the book of Isaiah for the fall of Lucifer. Melkor, when he loses heaven and is sent into the abyss of hell, loses the right to be called Melkor, which is Mighty One. He is now known merely as Morgoth, which means dark enemy. Now, Tolkien, remember, in his day job, was a philologist, professor of philology at Oxford University. He gives us a lot of clues about the deepest meaning of the Lord of the Rings linguistically, which we don't want to miss. So, Lucifer means light bearer, because Lucifer was the brightest of the angels. But when Lucifer, through his rebellion, falls into hell, he forfeits that name, because he's no longer the light bearer, but the prince of darkness. So then he becomes known in Hebrew as Satan. And the Hebrew word Satan means enemy or adversary. Morgoth means enemy. So Tolkien does exactly the same thing. The mighty one becomes the enemy, Morgoth. The brightest one, Lucifer, becomes the enemy, Satan. So you have this linguistic clue. And then we're told in the Silmarillion that the greatest of Melkor's servants, so the most powerful demon apart from Satan himself, is Sauron, the Dark Lord in the Lord of the Rings. In other words, the evil in the Lord of the Rings is satanic. Let's move into the Lord of the Rings itself. And again, Tolkien gives us lots of clues about things through the names he gives. He's an old English scholar. I mentioned in my breakout session yesterday about the influence of Beowulf on Lord of the Rings. Let's start with the evil characters. Some of the evil characters, Wormtongue. The old English word for dragon or serpent was worm, W-Y-M, vim, worm. So Wormtongue means dragon tongue or serpent tongue. And Gandalf says to Theoden, pointing to Wormtongue, see Theoden, here is a snake. And then Gandalf says, down on your belly, snake. And Wormtongue hisses his reply. So again, all of these clues that connect the evil character in Lord of the Rings to their satanic allegiance. So what sort of man is presented to us in this mirror to man that's being held up in the Lord of the Rings? Well, I'll tell you what's not being shown to us, and that is Homo sapiens, which is a technical label that scientific people gave to us about 200 years ago. Prior to that, it didn't exist as a label. And it's a very silly label for who we are, if we know any Latin. Right? Homo sapiens means wise man. That might be a name that an arrogant man might give to himself. And as it's a product of the Enlightenment, that's understandable. But anybody who knows anything about the history of humanity will know that the defining characteristic of the history of humanity is not wisdom. So Homo sapiens is a rather silly name for who we are. The other thing we do not see being presented to us as who we are in the Lord of the Rings is Homo economicus. That basically all we are consumers who are only interested in gratifying our own desires. Now what we get is a far older and more classical understanding of who we are, one in Greek and one in Latin. The first is anthropos, where we get the Greek word for man, where we get words like anthropology. Anthropos means he who looks up. What separates us from the rest of the animal world, from all other creatures, is we're the ones that look up. Now, I sometimes make this difference. The animal grazes. Man gazes. The animal is defined and constrained by his instinct. We can transcend our instinct with the free will we've been given. And our ability to love and to create. We look up. All of us are in the gutter, says Oscar Wilde. But some of us are looking at the stars. So this vision of who we are as anthropos. What does Samwise Gamgee say in one of the darkest moments of Lord of the Rings? Above all shadows rides the sun. You have to look up to know that. And the other name for who we are in the Lord of the Rings, a Latin word for who we are, Homo viator, man on a journey, a man on a quest, traveling man, pilgrim man. It's understanding who we are as our only purpose in life is to get to God. Our only purpose in life is to get to heaven. Each of us in our life story, which is our life journey, will face many dragons on that path to Christ. And only by his assistance, and we'll see how Tolkien also brings grace into the equation in a bit, only with his assistance can those dragons be slain. So Anthropos, he who looks up, and Homo viator. Okay, Homo viator, what sort of journey? Obviously, both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, it's a quest, right? They're all on a journey to achieve something. Well, Tolkien's technique, allegorically, he borrows from the Beowulf poet. And in my breakout session yesterday, I talked about the allegorical techniques that the Beowulf poet uses. And I think Beowulf is probably the largest single influence, literarily, on The Lord of the Rings. I don't think I have a lot of time to go into all of it, but the first part of the poem basically shows, just in the telling of the story, an analogy with the heresy of Pelagianism. And the heresy of Pelagianism, for those of you that don't know, and you might think, well, why do we really care about very old heresies? Is that most of the very old heresies tend to come back like boomerangs, usually with a different label on them. So the heresy of Pelagianism is what is now known as self-help. And if you actually go to big bookstores now, you might find some religious books somewhere buried in the self-help section. So self-help seems to have transplanted Christianity as a section in bookstores. Pelagianism taught that you can get to heaven by yourself. All you have to do is to read the gospel, listen to the words of Jesus, and do what Jesus says, and you can get to heaven through the triumph of your own will. And what that means, of course, is you don't need grace. You don't need any supernatural help from God to get you there. You can do it yourself. And we know that the Beowulf poet was probably a contemporary or near contemporary of St. Bede the Venerable. And in his Ecclesiastical History of England, he is preoccupied with the major heresy that's afflicting the English people at the time, which is Pelagianism. You don't need grace, therefore you don't need sacraments, therefore you don't need church. Just do it yourself. So in Beowulf, the poem is set up with this heroic hero, and he shows he's the strongest. He can swim farther and faster. He's stronger. He rips off Grendel's arm with his bare strength. He can do it himself. He's the strongest man in the world. And yet then he finds himself facing Grendel's mother, and his trusted sword has never let him down, and his strength has never let him down. He's not strong enough to defeat the monster. He's going to be killed. And as if by magic, a supernatural sword appears within reach. And this is about to be killed by Grendel's mother. He grabs the sword and uses this supernatural sword to slay the monster. And as soon as it drops down, the blade of it disappears. What the Beowulf poet's saying, he was probably a monk, is that Pelagianism is a heresy, and you cannot defeat evil through the triumph of your own will, however strong you are. Without supernatural assistance, you're dead. So, Tolkien does the same thing, as we shall see in The Lord of the Rings. But in the third part of the poem of Beowulf, the Beowulf poet uses numerical signifiers to draw parallels with the gospel. So we're told that Beowulf has 12 hand-picked warriors. and are picked out from amongst the rest. So when you know, if you know how to read literature, automatically you think, okay, a king with 12 hand-picked warriors, maybe there's something going on here that's related to the gospel. And then of course it's confirmed because one of the 12 is the traitor who raises the wrath of the dragon through his theft from the dragon's hoard. So Beowulf knows that now the dragon's wrath has been raised, he's the person that needs to destroy it, kill the dragon. He takes his hand-picked warriors with him, and when the dragon appears, all but one run off into the woods, leaving just one of his hand-picked warriors standing by him to fight the dragon. And at the very end of the poem, a burial mound has been raised in Beowulf's honour, and 12 knights on horseback are galloping in a circle around it. So first of all, the traitor has been replaced. There's 12 again. And the circle signifies eternity. What has been established here is permanent. So you see how the Beowulf poet, by using numerical signifiers, draws parallels between Beowulf's fight with the dragon and the Passion of Christ and the founding of the church. Well, Tolkien does the same thing. Tolkien does the same thing, but he does it not with numbers, but with dates. So what unlocks the whole of the Lord of the Rings is the date on which the ring is destroyed. And that date is March the 25th. Now, I've given talks on unlocking the Lord of the Rings at Ivy League schools such as Harvard, Princeton, and Columbia, and state universities. And I say, so what unlocks the Lord of the Rings is the date on which the ring is destroyed, March the 25th. They're all looking at me. What, I better give them a clue, right? What happens 9 months after March the 25th? April, May, June. At Christmas. Okay. Now, one thing you don't have to explain to college undergraduates is, you know, 9 months. What happens 9 months before if something else happened, right? And then you say, and imagine now that this is not the C.S. Lewis Foundation, but this is undergraduates at Princeton. Then you say, and because life begins at conception and not at birth, that March the 25th actually is more important than Christmas. And it's known, the feast is known as the Feast of the Annunciation. It's the moment when the Word becomes flesh. Amen. It's the moment when God becomes man. The most important date on the calendar. This is the date on which Tolkien has the ring destroyed. We should be doing the same thing as we're doing the Beowulf poem now. 12 hand-picked warriors, March the 25th, hang on. But also, Tolkien is a medievalist, and he knows that in the medieval and early church, the traditional date for Good Friday, for the crucifixion, was also March the 25th. Now, we've forgotten that because, of course, Good Friday is celebrated as a movable feast. It's not on the same date each year. So we don't actually append a particular specific date to the date of the crucifixion. But, of course, in history, it happened once on a real day, right? And the early church and medieval church believed that was March the 25th. Tolkien knew that. So March 25th is not just the date on which the Word becomes flesh, in which God becomes man. It's also the date on which God dies for us on the cross. This is the date on which the ring is destroyed. And then you can start, all the rest starts to, you can make sense of all the rest from that very fact. So, what's the one ring that's destroyed on March the 25th? The one ring to rule them all, and in the darkness bind them. What is original sin? The one sin to rule them all, and in the darkness bind them. And the one ring and the one sinner destroyed the same significant day. Which means, of course, the ring is synonymous with sin itself. So when you put the ring on, it's the act of sin. What happens when you put the ring on is you become invisible to the good world that God made, because you've excommunicated yourself from it. But you're actually more visible than ever to Sauron, because you've entered his world. And he can see you, and he has power over you. For as long as you're in sin, for as long as you're wearing the ring. And yet, of course, there's a big difference between wearing the ring and bearing the ring. The one who carries the weight of sin without committing sin is the cross bearer. So in this, Frodo becomes a Christ figure. And this is many of you may now know March 25th. This is a question. On what date do the Fellowship of the Ring leave Rivendell? Anybody know?
So it's December 25th.
Well done. Those who said that, well done. December the 25th. So Frodo's journey from Rivendell to Golgotha, Mount Doom, December 25th to March the 25th, signifies the life of Christ. All right, so we have Frodo in some sense as a Christ figure. It's very subtle. I mean, Frodo as a Christ figure is more subtle than Aslan as a Christ figure. Because, you know, Frodo is always just a hobbit. Aslan's always the son of the emperor over the sea, right? So it's only in his capacity as the ring bearer does he remind us of Christ. Otherwise, he's a hobbit. Much more subtle. So I want to go through most of the characters of the Fellowship with the time I have left now. If I have time, we'll have questions, by the way, but we'll see what happens here. So bear that in mind. Hobbits. Up to a point, the hobbits in general are everyman figures. Tolkien actually said in one of his letters, "I am, in fact, a hobbit." So we can see, in some sense, Frodo, of course, in one sense, is a Christ figure. But in another sense, he's an everyman figure, because we're all called to take up our cross and follow Christ. And of course, Samwise Gamgee, insofar as Frodo is the Christ figure, is the loyal disciple that will follow in the footsteps of Christ even into the valley of death, even into Mordor. But there's one character in the Lord of the Rings who represents us more than anybody else. Anybody want to maybe say who you think that might be?
Aragorn?
Sorry?
Gollum.
That's good, I'm getting to him. Not Aragorn, Boromir. And there's a very obvious reason. The Fellowship of the Ring has representatives of all the different races. Right, there's four hobbits, there's a dwarf, there's an elf, there's a wizard, and there's a king, because Aragorn's there as the king. And there's a man, the one who represents us, Boromir. Well, that's a sobering thought. Because Boromir is the traitor. Boromir is the one who betrays the Fellowship. Boromir is the one who will use the ring against the enemy. Now, of course, actually, we need to be a little bit fair to Boromir. Think about it. Put yourself in his position. His country, his nation, his civilization, his people are about to be overrun by an army led by the devil's greatest servant. Now, Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire, and it was. But even the Soviet Union wasn't as bad as the army of orcs that Sauron unleashes upon the West. So Boromir, why on earth are we not going to use this weapon? It's madness not to use this weapon. But the wise know, if you use evil means to a good end, you become evil. So it could, of course, be true that if they had used the ring against Sauron, maybe Minas Tirith would have defeated Sauron. But in so doing, Minas Tirith itself would have become an evil empire. And if Minas Tirith becomes an evil empire as the price for defeating an evil empire, it hasn't won, it's lost. The wise know that. Boromir lacked that wisdom. So we might think, well, Tolkien has a really pretty dark view of us. That's who we are, Boromirs. But think about it. He has an heroic and ultimately a holy death. Laying down his life for his friends. And in fact, the exchange of words between Aragorn, the king, and Boromir, the man, at Boromir's death, follows the form of the Catholic sacrament of penance. Confession. There has to be a confession of sins, there has to be a sorrow for sins, and then there has to be an absolution of those sins. Boromir confesses, Boromir says, I'm sorry, Boromir says, I failed, and Aragorn says, no, you won a great victory. And here we have Aragorn, if you like, in persona Christi, the person of Christ, Christ the King. So now we're thinking, okay, well, if our representative dies heroically and goes to heaven, perhaps Tolkien has letting us on a bit too easily. And it's actually accentuated because Boromir has a brother, Faramir. And the fact that he's a brother means an allegorical connection is being made, right? It's meant to see both of them as representing us. They're both our brothers as representatives of men. And by the way, if you've only seen the Peter Jackson movies and haven't read the book, I'm afraid that Peter Jackson pretty ruins Faramir as a character, so put that Faramir out of your head, right? In The Lord of the Rings, Faramir says, I would not snare even an orc with a falsehood. I would not tell a lie to the devil himself. No evil means to a good end. Well, Faramir is the antidote to Boromir's pride. He also says, I would not pick up the ring if I saw it lying at the side of the road. I'm not interested. So now we have our representatives, Boromir, the sort of Mary Magdalene figure, who nonetheless dies and goes to heaven because he's a penitent and has a heroic death. Faramir, who seems to be a saint, think, well, hey, we get off quite lightly, don't we? We're doing pretty well here in The Lord of the Rings, we human beings. But then, as someone said, the other everyman figure is Gollum. Because what happens if you become addicted to sin? It's all that you want. Having the ring, possessing the ring, which means being possessed by the ring, is the only thing you care about. The more you live your life addicted to sin, the more you cease to be the good hobbit that God made you to be, and the more you become a shriveled wreck. Amen. We should all be using a new verb, by the way, that's a neologism, which I want to enter the English language. If you keep doing that, you're going to golemize yourself. So, you know, who are we? The mirror of the man being held up. Yes, we're tempted to pride. Yes, we can understand that. Yes, we can die heroically. Yes, we can be saints. But yes, we can also ruin and wreck ourselves by becoming possessed by our possessions. What's known in The Hobbit is the dragon sickness. All right, so that's who we are. What about the face of Christ? We've already mentioned, of course, Frodo, insofar as he's the ring bearer, is cross bearing, insofar as his cross bearer is Christ figure. Gandalf, insofar as Gandalf dies, and certainly when you read the book, it has him spoiled for you by an older sibling or something. You think he is dead for hundreds of pages, which means you share that you catastrophe, that word that Tolkien invented, that good turn in the story, that sudden joyous turn in the story when we see him resurrected. And when we see Gandalf resurrected, he's not just resurrected, he's transfigured. He's no longer Gandalf the grey, he's Gandalf the white. And they can't even look directly at him because his robes are dazzling. He has to put his grey cloak over him. It's like a cloud going over the sun. So the vision of the resurrected Gandalf is a vision of the resurrected Christ and Christ transfigured. But only in his death, resurrection, and transfiguration, not anything else. He says, by the way, of course, Leviticus has doom, I am a servant of the secret fire. And Tolkien says in one of his letters, the secret fire is the Holy Ghost. Aragorn. Aragorn represents Christ in his kingship. The third part of the book, of course, is called The Return of the King. The king has power. The king has healing power. The hands of the king are the hands of a healer, says the wise woman of Gondor. He uses something called king's foil, which is a weed. Only Tolkien, by the way, I'm sure other people have done it, but I can't think of anybody. Tolkien's brilliance is such that he can even use a plant as a Christ figure. Right? King's foil is this weed that everyone thinks is worthless. What do you want that for? It's not pretty, it's not beautiful. But king's foil, king's leaf, right? That leaf in the hands of the king has great healing power. It's not really a weed, actually. It has the power of God. And of course, the return of the king, for Tolkien's imagination, obviously the once and future king is King Arthur. Also, there's the Jacobite aspect of English history, if you don't know it, that there's the glorious revolution in 1688. From my perspective, not very glorious. When the king, James II, is forced off the throne by an army of mercenaries from Holland. And so for 100 years, there's this Jacobite force waiting for the return of the king. And there are two Jacobite uprisings. The better known one, I'm sure many of you have heard of Bonnie Prince Charlie. Indeed. I know that the wonderful Stan Matson used to have us all sing Will You Know Come Back Again, which is of course
we'll be singing that later.
Oh, okay. Well, when you sing it, remember this is actually talking about Bonnie Prince Charlie, the true king. Yeah. Will you know come back again?
Amen.
So there's all of this as part of what's informing the return of the king. But of course, and most importantly, it's the return of the king. Right, we're all awaiting as Christians the second coming of Christ. There's also actually a very symbolism of political philosophy, Christian political philosophy, in the coronation of Aragorn. And again, this is not reproduced by Peter Jackson. But in the book, it is the ring bearer who presents the crown to Gandalf, who puts the crown on Aragorn's head. This is the political philosophy of the Holy Roman Empire, because Frodo is Christ. Frodo gives the authority to Gandalf, who's the Pope, and it's the Pope who has the authority of Christ who puts the crown on the head of the king. It follows the crowning of Charlemagne, first Holy Roman Empire, with that political philosophy behind it. But the final coup de grace, the most brilliant thing about the Lord of the Rings, is the bit the part of the Lord of the Rings which infuriated me the most when I first read it. And maybe you had the same experience. If you didn't know what's going to happen, you're reading it, you don't know what the story's going to be. We have followed Frodo by this point for 900 and something pages. He gets to the top of Mount Doom, excruciatingly slowly. I use the word excruciate there advisedly, excruciate from the cross. Right? He's there. Now is the easy part. I'll show you how easy it is, right? So easy, I'll do it again.
That's right.
Right? We've 900 pages to get to this moment. Right? And it's the easy part. He's done what? He's walked up the hill, so you've got to throw it in. But he doesn't do it. He doesn't throw it in. And you think, no. You can't do that. You can't do that to me. 900 pages I've followed you for this. Frodo, you are a miserable loser. And then it's your first ever exercise in literary criticism. Hang on for a second. It's not Frodo's fault. It's Tolkien's fault. Tolkien, you miserable loser. How dare you stop Frodo throwing that ring into the abyss? And then you realize, of course, a few pages later, when it dawns on you, this is the most brilliant part of the whole story. And it's directly connected to Beowulf and the same moral as those first two parts of Beowulf. If the ring signifies sin, Frodo cannot destroy the ring through the power of his own will. He needs supernatural assistance. He needs grace. Now you're thinking, Gollum? Yeah. Gollum is grace? How does that work out? Well, early on in the story, of course, Frodo says, I wish Uncle Bilbo had killed that miserable creature when he had the chance. It's a pity he didn't. To which Gandalf replies, pity? It was pity that stayed his hand. And Gandalf says, I'm sure that Gollum has some role still to play in this, for good or ill. And Bilbo's pity may save the lives of many, or many lives may be dependent on Bilbo's pity. Later on in the story, when Frodo has the chance to have Gollum killed, the Forbidden Pawn, he stays the hand of the archers and says, now I do see him, I do pity him. And at that part of the story, the whole of Gandalf's speech is repeated in italics. Now that means the writer wants us to get the point here, to connect this with what happened earlier. And later on, Sam also has the opportunity to kill Gollum and doesn't do so. So on three separate occasions, Gollum could have been killed with the absence of love. Because the most difficult commandment our Lord gives us is the commandment to love our enemy. Bilbo loved his enemy. Frodo loved his enemy. Sam loved his enemy. And if any of them had failed, Gollum would not have been there at the crucial moment. If you like, Gollum's presence at that moment was the reward for those earlier acts of love. And we're delivered by that love. I'm going to finish now on a somewhat lighter note. Well, that's a fairly light note, actually. Very good note. The Palantir stones. Those of you who know, they're the seeing stones in the Lord of the Rings. They when you look into them, they don't necessarily tell you a lie, but they will tell you what the dominant will that controls them wants you to see. Do you know what the word palantir means in Elvish? No? You don't know Elvish?
I'm not up on my Elvish.
Not up on your Elvish. Shame on you. Palantir means far-seeing or far-seer. The German word for television is Fernsehen, which means far-seer. The English word for television is television, which means far-seer, right? Tele, Greek for far. Video, to see in Latin. Tolkien's a linguist. He decides to call the Palantir stones a television. Now, and he said, I think it's a joke. I mean, we know during World War II, he was horrified by the way that the radio was being used to tell lies by all sides. Propaganda, no truth. Horrified, he says it in one of his letters. When he's writing The Lord of the Rings, television is new technology. It's out there. It exists. I think it's a joke. And of course, Denethor in the story spends too much time watching television. So the moral of the story is, if you watch too much television, you'll commit suicide. Don't do it. Thank you very much.
Just got to leave the airport before too long, and so we do have a couple of minutes for a couple of questions.
Yeah. Knowing that Tolkien was Catholic, and that he said his Roman Catholicism informed, I wonder if you could comment on how perhaps the Catholic view of Mary informed the women in the book, Galadriel and maybe others.
Great question. Well, Tolkien says in one of his letters, he put all of his love for the Blessed Virgin Mary into the characterization of Galadriel in the story. So he states that specifically. Catholic dimension. And by the way, Peter Jackson does that well. I mean, in the extended edition, when they leave Rivendell, the last view we have of Galadriel looks very much like, you know, images of the Blessed Virgin, Our Lady of Fatima, Our Lady of Lourdes, those sorts of images of Mary. So Jackson, giving credit where it's due, right? But the other specifically Catholic thing would be Lembas, because Lembas, of course, the Elven waybread, and again in Elvish means Lembas means life bread or bread of life, and we're told in the book that it feeds the will. And so that's all that they have to live on while they're walking through the Valley of Death in Mordor, is this life bread that feeds the will, and that's what they needed feeding more than anything else at that time.
Wonderful. One or two more?
I had a friend one time connect Gandalf to an imperfect prophet. One who sees into the future, but not perfectly about the coming of the cross-bearer and the role of the cross-bearer. How would you speak to Gandalf as the office of prophet?
Well, I think that's a good analogy that's valid. I mean, bear in mind, you know, when Tolkien says there are points of applicability, that's Tolkien's word, those points of applicability can be multiple points of applicability. Some are more obvious and more illicit than others. Some stretch it to the point of breaking the line of credulity. In other words, it doesn't work. I think that one does work to see Gandalf as a prophet. Really, in the wider legendarium, it's not really illicit to read this into the book necessarily, but he's an angel. We know from what Tolkien says and other things, he's actually a guardian angel. That's why he says, I'm a servant of the secret fire. Because it's before the time of Christ, so that no one's allowed to actually reveal the fullness of revelation, because this is happening, in the days of the Old Testament, in fact, many hundreds of years prior to that. That's one.
I loved what you said about the most frustrating part happening in Mordor. I thought you were going to say it's the whole sixth book where they go all the way back to the Shire, and it's, you think the story is over and then there's so much more. So I'd love to hear what you think about that section and some of the themes that Tolkien's trying to pull out there.
Great question. Of course, Peter Jackson leaves all of that out. And I don't necessarily fault him for that, or leaving out Tom Bombadil. There's a whole chapter in my book, Frodo's Journey. There's no point selling books anymore because you bought them all already. Thank you very much. My wife and children will be very grateful. There's a whole chapter in my book, Frodo's Journey, The Enigma of Tom Bombadil. No time to talk about him now, but that's also left out by Peter Jackson. But no, the chapter, The Scouring of the Shire, is crucial. Because that's what where Tolkien is showing us how these, if you like, cosmic battles between good and evil play themselves out politically at grassroots level. And how at grassroots level we have to restore the kingdom. And so it's lots of things about the Scouring of the Shire. It's certainly Catholic political philosophy, Catholic social teaching, as in various papal encyclicals, the idea of distributism, the idea of the small people having real power politically and economically, not succumbing to industrialism, to factories. So there's a great deal of actually Tolkien's politics at work in that chapter. So it's important, and that we shouldn't. There's an element of anticlimax after that, but it is important, absolutely. Thank you very much. God bless. Thank you.
We've got a couple of minutes.